You're listening to KRUU LP 100.1 FM, the voice of Fairfield, Iowa. Welcome to Writer's Voices with Monica and Caroline. I'm your host, Monica Hadley. With me is my co-host and mother, Caroline Kilborn.
And happy Friday the 13th, everyone, and happy Valentine's Day tomorrow.
That's right. So this is a fun time of year.
Yeah, it is. Double whammy here.
And that music that we were listening to is called Scenic Sketches. And I keep meaning to get the musician and the author, and one of these days I'll have that information in front of me.
You have a lot of things on your plate, Monica.
A lot of things. But here we are back again for Writer's Voices, which is one of the fun things that I do.
Yeah, we have a most interesting book to an author to talk to today. Just really, really some interesting stuff. I know that people are going to want to read this book, I'm sure.
Well, the title of the book is The Highly Sensitive Person. It's by Elaine N. Aron, Ph.D. Elaine is a Ph.D. She obtained her doctorate from Pacific Graduate Institute and trained at the Young Institute in San Francisco. Widely published in academic journals, she conducts workshops for highly sensitive persons around the country and is the author of the Highly Sensitive Persons Workbook, and I believe at least one or two other books as well. Welcome to Writer's Voices, Elaine.
I am glad to be here.
Where are you calling us from today?
I'm calling from Manhattan. If I crank my head a little bit, I can see the Empire State Building.
Is that where you spend most of your time?
No. About 3 months of the year, I live here, and then I'm still not here all the time. I go back and forth to California, which is my home, and I have a psychotherapy practice. I go back to see my patients, or I talk to them on the phone between times, but that's where I am usually.
I'm sure they're glad to see you when you return.
Oh, they're very glad.
Yeah, I'll bet.
Well, what brings you to New York?
Well, my husband teaches at State University of New York at Stony Brook. He teaches social psychology. And in fact, I was kind of chuckling because our anniversary is actually today, the 13th.
Oh.
Yeah. And tomorrow on the 14th is Valentine's Day. And since my husband studies love, he's always pretty busy giving interviews on our anniversary.
But this time you're giving an interview.
I'm giving the interview, right.
Well, okay. Now that's a whole other subject that unfortunately probably won't have time to get into, but your husband studies love?
Yes, and he actually studies love in the brain and how it's located. He looks at people, how long they've been in love, how they feel when they're rejected. I mean, I do this research with him, but he's the main one. But it's research that goes way back, but then we started adding the magnetic resonance imagery stuff of the brain as that's become a big deal.
Has he written a book on this?
Some studies of that on same method used on highly sensitive people, too, so we can talk about that.
Okay.
No, he's never written a book on it. We've tried to think of a way to make it a really interesting, advice-y sort of book, and it's not. It's science, and it's theory and data, and it's interesting. But
yeah.
Well, I hate to ask, but does he get referred to as Dr. Love?
Oh, yes, this happened.
Dr. Strangelove?
Oh, gosh.
Well, it fits in well with your expertise, because the section of your book on relationships and love is quite interesting. And
then I actually wrote The Highly Sensitive Person in Love because I had so much knowledge about relationships and relationship research. And so that's a book I really recommend, too. In fact, the first survey that's ever been done on differences in sexual attitudes and practices based on temperament is one that I did. Oh. And it's only in that book. I never published the results, but it's quite interesting. And it talks about the problems people have if they're married to someone else who's as sensitive as they are, and the problems people have if they're not matched on that. And those can be pretty big unless you work on them.
Well, Elaine, let's give our listeners a little background and kind of define what is a highly sensitive person.
Right. Well, they possess a trait that about 15 to 20% of the population has. In fact, it's about that percentage in all, I think, every animal that's ever been studied. Certainly most species, from fruit flies to chimpanzees, have different personalities. The individuals have different personalities, and the difference here is in being sensitive, there's a preference to notice things more closely, to observe and get the subtleties in a situation, and there's many consequences to that. And the other 80% prefer to go right out into the situation and explore, sort of boldly go where no man has gone before, as opposed to watch, wait, and listen, kind of. Don't look before you leap, kind of.
Jump in with both feet, as it were.
Right. They're different strategies. And sensitive people and animals have more complex nervous systems. And because they're doing most of their exploration by looking and thinking rather than by moving around. And so that is the sensitive person has a more sensitive nervous system and a preference to use that nervous system so that they tend to wait before plunging into action. And the downside of that is often what is most noticed by sensitive people is that they're easily overstimulated. If they're going to pick up on a lot of subtleties, they're going to be also overwhelmed by a lot of grossness. So when noise is, music is on too loud or clothing is scratchy or they're also sensitive to their own body, so if they have a headache or pain or stomach ache, all these things interfere more with them and require attention or awareness, and that kind of drains the supply in them more quickly over the day. So many people will notice this about themselves or someone else who's sensitive, that, you enjoyed, like on a vacation, you enjoyed maybe going to museums during the day, but you don't want to go out to a nightclub at night. You want to stay in your room.
Are they sensitive to weather changes as well?
Yes. The sensitivity that people have varies from person to person, but they are definitely affected in particular by cloudy days and wintertime, that seasonal affective.
It's interesting that I'd always, I originally thought of the sensitivity as being towards like loud noises and bright lights and being around people a lot, and I never really thought about the tactile sensitivity. My son, when he was little, would not sleep on regular sheets. He could only have flannel sheets to sleep on. He would not wear denim jeans. He would wear corduroys because they were softer. He loved silk shirts. He had like an entire collection of silk shirts in junior high school, and when I bought a sofa, he had to pick out the fabric for the sofa because it had to be soft for him to sit on. And I never thought about, I just thought that was a real peculiarity of him, but it sounds like that fits right in with this definition.
Yeah, it does.
Yeah. That's interesting. So how can somebody... Well, I have two questions, really. One is, you say that all species, about 20%, exhibit this. How do you test that in animal and insect species?
Well, that's a complicated subject, but often it's mostly by observation.
Mm.
And various terms come up, like these are shy versus bold, or reactive versus non-reactive. With fruit flies, they call them sitters versus rovers. From the behavior that they're seeing. Yeah. And so it doesn't really matter what the name of the trait is. It doesn't have to be sensitivity from my point of view, but I think that's a good term for covering, say, we can't call it reflective because a fruit fly isn't reflective quite. So it has to be something that kind of covers them all. Shyness, I think, has really it's a misnomer, because to my mind, shyness is a fear of social evaluation, and we're not born with that. That would be a disaster if we were born afraid of what other people thought of us, you know, to an excessive degree. So I think that this is that the trait, well, I'll give you an example of how it's studied, was found in pumpkin seed sunfish. They put traps in the pond, and they waited for fish to go into it, and the fish, like 80% of the fish would enter the traps, and about 20% did not enter the traps. Then they took them into the lab, and they observed their behavior under various other kinds of things, so that they could see that they behaved this way in a number of settings. They ended up calling them the shy and the bold sunfish, and I said, why don't you call them the smart and the stupid?
Yeah.
Yeah, really.
That's what I was thinking, too.
Right. But usually the strategy works out so that there are advantages and disadvantages. So in another context, if there was some food out in the middle of the pond, it would be the bold ones that would get it first.
Mm.
If there was a predator out in the middle of the pond, the bold ones would be the ones to be eaten. So it just depends on what's going on in the situation as to whose strategy is working. And it's interesting about people in that way. Sensitive people have very good intuition, so they often sense how things are going to turn out. And I don't think it's any kind of psychic ability. It's simply that if you paid attention to a lot of details, it's possible to extrapolate from them what's likely to happen in the future more accurately. So sensitive people may not be able to endure all the stimulation of reading tons and tons of material and figuring things out, but they can read a little and from that have a pretty good guess of how things are going. So it's a different strategy for figuring something out or making a guess about the future.
Mm-hmm. Well, Elaine, tell us a little bit about your background and how you came to write The Highly Sensitive Person.
Well, would you like me to read a little section on that, or I can
sure.
tell you what would you prefer?
Why don't you read the section on that?
Okay. About myself, I am a research psychologist, university professor, psychotherapist, and published novelist. What matters most, however, is that I am a highly sensitive person like you. I am definitely not writing from on high, aiming down to help you, poor soul, overcome your post-syndrome. I know personally about our trait, its assets and its challenges. As a child at home, I hid from the chaos in my family. At school, I avoided sports, games, and kids in general. What a mixture of relief and humiliation when my strategy succeeded and I was totally ignored. In junior high school, an extrovert took me under her wing. In high school, that relationship continued, plus I studied most of the time. In college, my life became far more complicated. After many stops and starts, including a four-year marriage undertaken too young, I finally graduated Phi Beta Kappa from the University of California, Berkeley. But I spent my share of time crying in restrooms, thinking I was going crazy. My research has found that retreating like this, often to cry, is typical of highly sensitive people. In my first try at graduate school, I was provided with an office to which I also retreated and cried, trying to regain some calm. Because of such reactions, I stopped my studies with a master's degree, even though I was highly encouraged to continue for a doctorate. It took 25 years for me to gain the information about my trait that made it possible to understand my reactions, and so complete that doctorate. When I was 23, I met my current husband and settled down into a very protected life of writing and rearing a son. I was simultaneously delighted and ashamed of not being, quote, out there. I was vaguely aware of my lost opportunities to learn, to enjoy more public recognition of my abilities, to be more connected with all kinds of people. but from bitter experience, I thought I had no choice. Some arousing events, however, cannot be avoided. I had to undergo a medical procedure from which I assumed I would recover in a few weeks. Instead, for months, my body seemed to resound with physical and emotional reactions. I was being forced to face once again that mysterious, fatal flaw of mine that made me so different. So I tried some psychotherapy and got lucky. After listening to me for a few sessions, my therapist said, "But of course you were upset. You're a highly sensitive person." "What is this?" I thought. "Some excuse?" She said she had never thought much about it, but from her experience, it seemed that there were real differences in people's tolerance for stimulation and also their openness to the deeper significance of an experience, good or bad. To her, such a sensitivity was hardly a sign of a mental flaw or disorder. At least she hoped not, for she was highly sensitive herself. I recall her grin, "As are most of the people who strike me as really worth knowing." I spent, just to go on to the research behind this book, as knowledge about my trait changed my life, I decided to read more about it, but there was almost nothing available. I thought the closest topic might be introversion. The psychiatrist Carl Jung wrote very wisely on the subject, calling it a tendency to turn inward. The work of Jung himself, a highly sensitive person, has been a major help to me. But the more scientific work on introversion was focused on introverts not being sociable, and it was that idea which made me wonder if introversion and sensitivity were being wrongly equated. So, I go on about the interviews I did, but I should just say that 30% of sensitive people are extroverts, so it's not introversion.
Okay. Oh, so they can't.
I'm ruled out.
Okay.
Right. And so then why, so you started studying this sort of because
I was not planning to write a book.
Okay. So how did you decide to write the book?
Well, I was doing interviews, and then the local newspaper heard about that. And so they did a news story. I remember it was Born to Be Mild. It was a takeoff on Born to Be Wild.
Cute. And where was this?
This was in Santa Cruz.
Okay.
And it must have been about 1993 or 4. And people started wanting, like calling me and writing me after, I didn't, my phone number was not in the article or my address, but people found me, and a lot of people. And so I agreed to give a lecture at the library, just a free lecture, sort of explain myself so that maybe people would go away. So the library room was huge, huge, and it was filled to overflowing, standing room over. People were being turned away.
Oh, my. You really hit a nerve.
I really hit a nerve, and I had no idea this was going to happen. It was not my intention. People wanted more. They wanted me to give a course or something, so I gave a few courses, and then I thought, well, I had nothing much to say, but they would give advice to each other, and I would listen. Yeah, that's a good idea. That's a good idea. And eventually I realized I didn't want to do any more of these courses, but I had quite a list of things that people were doing to cope with their sensitivity. So somebody had an agent, a children's book agent, and she went out and sold it to a small publisher who has since gone bankrupt, not because of this book.
I hope not.
Because of some decisions partly that he made with his book, and that he only printed 5,000 copies, and they were sold in a couple weeks.
Oh,
and
my goodness.
While they were being sold in San Francisco, they were top of the best-selling list in the San Francisco Bay Area, but you couldn't buy the books anymore. And so I was doing book signings and things, and people were just signing little things that you stick into a book after the book comes, basically.
Oh, wow.
So anyway, then it did so well so quickly that Broadway Books, which is part of Random House, bought the rights for the paperback. And then the book really took off. And it's sold, I think, about 1 million copies worldwide. And it's been translated into 12 languages.
Wow.
And is it's still in print?
Oh, yes. And it still sells.
And it still sells.
As about as well now as it ever did.
And are you still publicizing it much? Do you?
No, it's all word of mouth. I've never had national coverage except one article in a Parade magazine. You know, that Sunday throwaway kind of thing.
Yeah.
But I've never been on a national TV show. I've been on a few, you know, local TV shows, you know, like in Portland or Los Angeles, but nothing that would really reach the whole nation.
And yet, the book seems to have gotten out there despite that.
Yes, it just kind of, as I say, by word of mouth.
Now, this has become, I mean, it sounds like that this whole field has really become your life's work. Is that true, or?
Yes, although I am writing an entirely different book for the last 10 years. It's about to come out, so.
Oh, cool.
Since we're talking to me as a writer, I have to say.
Yeah.
You know, I didn't feel done with ideas. There was and is a sort of place where I could be sort of the empress of highly sensitive people if I wanted to be. So people are forming organizations about it all over the world, and, you know, I could teach therapists how to deal with sensitive people. I could teach coaches. I could do whatever I wanted with it, you know.
And you have done some of that.
I've not trained anybody. Mm-hmm. I've written a book that's not out yet, Psychotherapy with Highly Sensitive People, and I've done some seminars.
Okay.
Well, you said when you were teaching the classes that people were giving each other advice, and so that's kind of interesting that highly sensitive people maybe like to help other highly sensitive people, you think?
Well, yes. I think mainly they were just comparing notes. They were so amazed to find each other. It was like nobody knew these other people existed. Because they didn't even know, they felt different, but they didn't know what their difference was. So it was quite an amazing thing, and it still is, when highly sensitive people get together in the same room, the whole room feels different, and that's wonderful. And just the fact that they can compare notes and say, oh, you feel that way? Oh, my goodness, the same thing has happened to me. Not identical by any means. They can have quite different attitudes and all that, but they...
But it sounds like highly sensitive people are often, that trait is denigrated in our culture.
Oh, yeah.
A lot. And that part of the, you know, reading through your book, that one of your aims or goals was to get highly sensitive people to reframe their self-concept based on knowing what this trait means and what the advantages of it can be, that it's not just a negative thing.
Right. And part of the negative comes very definitely from the culture, because we know that, there was a study comparing Japanese elementary school children and children in Canada, you know, the North American culture, and sensitive, quiet children in China were the most popular children with their peers, and sensitive, quiet children in Canada were the least popular with their peers.
Interesting. Interesting.
So culture affects it. Definitely. But
you're listening to Writers' Voices with Monica and Caroline, and our guest today is Elaine Aron, author of The Highly Sensitive Person. Elaine, I understand that you lived in Fairfield at one time.
Oh, I sure did.
And when was that?
We were there for, I think, about 8 to 10 years in the about 75 to 85, something like that.
And what were you doing while you were here?
74, I think. Home.
Wow.
Other than that, I guess 70, trying to, I guess about 72 or 3.
Okay. So right when MIU first came here?
Yes. In fact, we started in Santa Barbara.
Okay.
And then we came. We made the move. We were actually with Maharishi when they made the move. And so we left lovely Santa Barbara and came back to, at that time, smelly Fairfield, because it seemed like it was just soggy mud and pigs.
Oh, yeah.
Everybody sort of warned us this is what we were coming back to. So we did a lot to get the university started in terms of getting accreditation for the psychology department.
Wow. And so you were a professor in the psychology department?
Yes, I was, and so was my husband, yeah.
And what's your husband's name?
Art Aron.
Art Aron, so... So we probably have some listeners who remember you.
Oh, I'm sure. I'm sure you do.
Probably so.
Yeah. Have you been back to Fairfield in recent years?
Not real recent years, no.
Well, we certainly hope you make it back one of these days. You'll be surprised at the changes.
Mm-hmm. You will.
I'll bet. Yeah. I'll bet.
It's a very artistic community, and a lot of writers, a lot of successful writers here.
Yeah.
Successful artists, musicians. The whole cultural aspect of the community has grown tremendously.
So, oh, that sounds wonderful.
Yeah, yeah. It's really, and we even have people moving here to be part of that community who aren't meditators.
That's good. That's really good.
Yeah. So, did any of the work that you did while you were here contribute to this book?
Well, I can't think of anything there, but I'll tell you that my husband's entire theory, our theory, we wrote a book together about it. He calls it self-expansion theory from the tape, if any of you have heard it, of Maharishi talking about love is always directed towards the self, and he talks about, of course, the self being eventually, you know, the unbounded absolute, not our personal self.
Mm.
But that's been interesting to base what's become a very popular theory in his field on something that was something Maharishi said, and we kind of like that.
Oh, that's very interesting. Yeah. Well, let's go back. Let's get back to talking about the highly sensitive person and some of the information in this book. How can somebody tell if they qualify as a highly sensitive person?
Well, there's a self-test that is in the book and also on my website.
And what's your website address?
hsperson.com.
Okay. And this, the self-test is a series of questions?
Yes, and my husband and I after I did the interviews, I came up with about 62 things that I'd gotten from the interviews that might be true of highly sensitive people, and then we gave the 62 to hundreds of people, and we boiled it down to the questions that if you said yes to one, you were likely to say yes to this one, too. So it was a kind of a compact set of things that most of the people who seem to be highly sensitive agreed to. So it's not just something that I made up in my head, as are many kind of little self-assessments and self-help books. And it's quite odd, interesting, that the items are so varied. I'll read you.
Okay.
Some of them. I seem to be aware of subtleties in my environment. Other people's moods affect me. Those make sense. Mm-hmm. I tend to be very sensitive to pain. So there's a really different thing, but mm-hmm. It's true for them. I find myself needing to withdraw during busy days into bed or into a darkened room or any place where I can have some privacy and relief from stimulation. Well, that was the part of that story that I was telling about myself.
Right.
Particularly sensitive to the effects of caffeine. I'm easily overwhelmed by things like bright lights, strong smells, coarse fabrics, or sirens close by. I have a rich, complex inner life. That's a different take
mm-hmm.
on it. I'll skip some of these. I'm deeply moved by the arts or music. I am conscientious. I startle easily. So those are some of them. I'm making a point to avoid violent movies and TV shows. Being hungry creates a strong reaction in me. So that gives you a feeling for the breadth of it. When
right.
I must compete or be observed while performing a task, I become so nervous or shaky that I do much worse than I would otherwise. So that was the other point I was trying to remember about why sensitive people tend to be seen as there's kind of something wrong with them. They feel it themselves because when they're put on the spot, more or less, to give a speech or to play music or, you know, stepping up the bat in a baseball game or whatever, they're more likely to perform worse than if no one was watching them.
Mm.
People actually kind of do better in the clinch or do better when they have an audience, but sensitive people so often don't, and it's distressing to them, and that often causes them to avoid those situations, which then makes people feel that there's something wrong with them. You know, that there's kind of, interestingly, in this country, if you have a group of people sitting around and people are quiet, Some people are quiet in the first meeting. The quiet people are judged, even by mental health professionals in the group, are judged as less intelligent and less mentally healthy.
Really?
Have the group meet for 5 or 6 weeks, the opinion reverses.
Yeah.
Usually the people who start out quiet are seen as most intelligent and mentally healthy.
Oh,
yeah.
Interesting.
The prejudice we have about quietness, we project certain things onto it.
So Caroline, in your experience as a teacher, you know, both in a school teacher and teaching music instruments, did you have students that fit this definition? That, you know, that did more poorly when they were being watched or observed than they
were? Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. That's why I didn't have recitals.
Mm-hmm.
Because I went through so many recitals in my childhood and never enjoyed them. And so I just didn't feel that was, you know, that was necessary. So, I know, you know, they would do well with me, but in a situation where they had to perform, sometimes they would perform, you know, different things, but it was never easy. It was never easy. I was interested in her, in here, she's talking about deep breathing, and I have always been able to breathe through my diaphragm because I'm a singer, but I know there's a theory, and I think it's medically proven that there's a nerve that runs down from your diaphragm, your whole body, and if you breathe through your diaphragm slowly, you can calm your whole body. And I do that frequently. And when I have to get up and sing, I start to breathe very deeply and calm myself down. It works.
So, Elaine, let's talk about some of the techniques that you have in the book to help highly sensitive people deal with their stimulation.
Well, sometimes I divide it into preventing and managing while it's occurring and recovering from it. Preventing it has a lot to do with knowing your limits and appreciating that they're different than other people. So you have to say no to things. You have to learn to say no, even though sensitive people like to please people. And they also can see the great advantages in doing something if only their bodies would allow them to do it. So you have to begin to learn to judge how much you can do and prevent it, prevent getting over-aroused. By over-arousal, I mean when you're overstimulated, then the effect on your body is over-arousal. That nerve you're talking about, Caroline, is the vagus nerve, and it connects the stomach and the lungs and the heart all together. It's the sympathetic nervous system that allows you to deal with a threat.
Uh-huh.
It makes you kind of get close to panic, that fight-or-flight response. And the parasympathetic nervous system is one that settles down, helps us to breathe, digest, relax. And so you're turning on the parasympathetic nervous system by doing physical things that it would create if it were in charge. Sort of jumpstart it by mentally deciding, I'm going to operate this organ, my lungs, in a way that would be more parasympathetic. And then you do that and you kind of reset the whole thing. So that's something that I use a lot, too. And somebody taught me that if you want to be sure you're breathing from your diaphragm, blow out on your exhale. You blow up like a blowing up a balloon, and your next breath is from deep. And that's a good way to get people started.
You also put your hand on your belly button, and if it's moving out when you breathe, then you know that you're doing it from your diaphragm. It's hard to do sometimes if you've never done it, and people say, "Oh gosh, I don't think I can do that," but they can. A little practice, they can.
Yeah, that's why I use that blowing out the balloon method. And sometimes I'll tell people, "Okay, you feel you're really tense. You're sitting at a stoplight. Do it 10 times. Just blow a balloon 10 times in your mind, and it's very calming."
You know, I think I learned to do that diaphragm breathing at some time when I was, I think, from taking voice lessons, and it became very natural to me where I did it all the time. And recently I had a yoga teacher who said that I wasn't getting enough air in my chest. I was breathing entirely from my belly, and I wasn't doing enough up in my chest.
Everybody has their own theory.
yes, that's right.
So prevention.
Uh-huh. And another thing that we can do is think about how to reduce the stimulation in the setting. For instance, if you're going to a place that's new and maybe a lot of new people and that seems like it'll be overstimulated, it's so much easier if you go with others, possibly even a group of others, so that you're kind of buffered from the newness.
Mm-hmm.
If you're going to be in a place, to perform, if you can go there the day before and see the place and even perform in that place, it takes away that part of what's overstimulating. You still have the crowd, but at least the room is familiar to you.
It's like when I saw this movie where these basketball players from a small school went to a large venue to play in a tournament, and you know, it was overwhelming to them, and the coach said, okay, just walk off this floor now. Just pace off this floor. It's the same size as our floor at home. The basket is the same height. It's just that the rest of the room is so huge that it intimidates you.
Mm-hmm.
And I'll never forget that, you know, and they did that, and then they were able to do what they had to do because they realized it was the same floor.
You're listening to Writer's Voices with Monica and Caroline, and our guest today is Elaine Aron, Dr. Elaine Aron, author of The Highly Sensitive Person. So, Elaine, in your book, you talked about wanting to choose a neutral description term for this trait, and even with using highly sensitive person, you know, you discussed how some people might hear it as a negative, oversensitive, and others to whom it didn't apply might feel that you're saying that they're not sensitive.
Right.
So are you still happy with this term as the kind of the defining term for this trait?
Not entirely, but I've not come up with, you know, pretty hard to change now. I always liked highly reflective people. I thought that kind of captured it a lot, but it feels too restrictive, not only restricting with animals, but also it sounds a little bit heady or something, and people.
That's our local train outside the station there.
Well, you know, I think it's good because everybody, you're indicating here that everybody is sensitive to a degree, but there are some people that are more highly sensitive than others.
Right. And by the way, there are just as many boys as girls born with this trait, but obviously it's much harder to be a boy. They're less likely to recognize themselves as sensitive or to own up to it. Every item on my self-test is one in which equal numbers of men and women answered yes to it.
Oh, interesting.
However, even then, when they're taking the overall test, men score lower than women. It's the effect of doing the entire test that as they go along, they start sort of balking at even though individually they would just be as likely as anybody else to say yes to them.
But they are sort of hesitant to define themselves this way.
Many men are. Others kind of really know it and are glad to have more of an explanation for it. But it's true that whenever a man interviews me or I just discuss it with him, I always notice that there's this kind of intense reaction of some sort. Laughter, making jokes about, attacking the ideas, or just becoming very, very interested and involved and wanting to talk about their childhoods. And it can go the gamut, but it's just so much harder for men.
I can see that because of our culture.
Well, you have an endorsement on the cover of this by the John Gray, the author of Men Are From Mars, Women Are From Venus. And he says, this remarkable book gives a fresh perspective, a sigh of relief, and a good sense of where we belong in society. So I thought that was a pretty fine endorsement from him, because he wrote a most interesting book, too.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, how did you get that endorsement?
Well, I knew John Gray.
That helps.
Right. Well, I just asked him, and he said yes. It was that simple.
Cool. And do you think that helped helped
oh, yes,
sell
I
your
think
book?
Certainly at the time that the book was published, that was a huge help. Yeah. And for some years after that. Some people I know began to have a kind of a backlash reaction to that whole idea.
Right.
And so sometimes I've wondered if it's as big of a help now.
But that's true, yeah.
It's there. And
yeah. I personally, I've always had an issue with making these clear-cut men are this way, women are that way distinctions. I don't like it myself.
Me too.
But you know, I can understand why some people find it useful. Now, one of the characteristics that you talk about for the highly sensitive person is the awareness of more details and subtle distinctions. And this awareness of many details has also been said to be characteristic of ADD people, but in their case, it sort of is, you know, awareness of many details is cited as one cause of high distractibility for ADD people. So what are your thoughts about the difference between a person who is overstimulated by taking in so much detail and a person who is distractible because of taking in so much detail? Is there a distinction?
People with ADD have trouble. If you put them in a quiet room and ask them to read, it's almost too much for them. They generally speaking, they remain kind of amped up and distracted. But if you put a sensitive person into a quiet setting and ask them to do some work, they do it much better. And in general, I mean, I've had a few people say that they have both traits, which is possible because we don't know exactly what ADD is caused by, but it's possible that it would simply be a different thing. Although many people with ADD are described as impulsive, and sensitive people are the opposite. They're not impulsive.
Oh,
they want to think
okay.
before they act.
Right. So it does seem like, in most cases, these would be mutually exclusive
right.
qualities.
Right.
Yeah. Well, Elaine, let's talk a little bit about your writing, your life as a writer.
Sure. That'd be fun.
How much time do you spend writing compared to, you know, being a therapist or some of the other roles that you have?
Well, I think I spend about 2.5 days a week writing when I have something that needs to be written. And I do a quarterly newsletter for highly sensitive people that's on you can get it at my website. It's free. And that takes some writing. I've got one of those due right now.
And the website, again, is hsperson.com. So do you have a particular writing routine that you follow?
Well, I'll tell you something funny. When I was, before I went to MIU, I was trying to write on my own, like I wanted to write fiction and short stories, and I just couldn't get myself to write. I would procrastinate.
I know that one.
Right. MIU, we were turning out this second-year psychology course. It was a month-long course, and other courses, too. And we had to prepare all this material, the long summary, the short summary, the this, and the that, you know. And it was just hundreds of pages of material, and you'd write it, and then you'd edit it, and you'd send it for typing, you'd edit it some more, then you'd send it to a committee, because we never send anything out funny in a committee reading it, and then you'd revise it again, and it was just constant turnaround, write. When I left MIU, I found that I had so much ability to work hard for a sustained time at writing that is really just carried over into my life as a writer. I don't know what would have happened if I hadn't had that experience. Mm. The first thing that I did was I wrote several novels, but I had a published novel that was based on the Mahabharata. It was called Samraj. It was published in England. It was never published here, but it did well. And
is that still available? If someone wanted to...
Amazon about that. No, it's not still in print.
Okay.
There may be copies floating around. For a while I was selling. I had a couple boxes of them left. I'd like to have it published in the United States because I think it's a wonderful book. But at the time, everybody said, a story about India won't go in the United States unless it's a modern story with an American or a European as part of the plot. And this is, of course, doesn't have that.
Well, I think times have changed.
I know, and so I really just have to haul that book out because it's actually three volumes, and I wrote
the
first volume, and the second one is actually written but was not published, and the third one I have in my mind. It's the hardest one, of course. One with the battle, but yeah, I'd like to finish that someday. But then I realized that, I didn't really have a plan until this thing with the research on highly sensitive people, and then I turned to nonfiction. I wasn't planning to write nonfiction.
Now, when you said that you had the idea for the book that came out of doing these workshops for people and so forth, and that you knew somebody who had an agent and they sold the book, so you actually had a publisher lined up before you wrote?
Oh, always for nonfiction, you want to have a book proposal.
Right.
I mean, they want sample chapters.
Right.
And it's really good to have a good agent because your agent will get your proposal into such good shape that it will sell well, because an agent does not want to promote a proposal that they're ashamed of, that makes them look bad. So then you have a proposal that is really ripe for purchase by somebody. It's hard to get an agent, but in some ways it's more important to have an agent than a publisher, because a good agent will get you a good publisher.
So how long did you spend working on the proposal?
Oh, for my second book, forever. The first book didn't have a very good agent, and I didn't have a very good proposal. But I also was bucking the fact that nobody had ever heard of the idea before, they said.
Right.
And some of them said, well, most people are highly sensitive, so this is kind of redundant. And other people said, it's something that would only appeal to a fraction of the population, so we don't want to do it. And then finally they said, somebody said, well, it's an unknown topic, and you could write something on codependency, and then when you're famous, come back and write this.
And yet you were able to find a publisher.
Yes, a very small publisher that, you know, didn't give me hardly any advance and was printed 5,000 copies. And they hoped, because I had already begun to give these courses and things, they hoped that you know, some people would buy it.
Now, you must have had somebody, or maybe you had the knowledge yourself, to not give away too many rights to that publisher, because it sounds like...
Kind of up to the agents should know what you can and can't do, and then, you know, it depends on whether you're in a position to bargain or not.
Right.
Author, you take what you get.
Because we've heard stories of people who, you know, started out with a small publisher and gave away so many rights that when the book really took off, they were stuck with that publisher and weren't able to go with someone who was better equipped to handle it.
Right. Well, I gave them just about everything, but what happened was Broadway bought the paperback rights from the little company because the little company wasn't going to do the paperback.
Oh, wow.
So that was fortunate. And then Broadway did my other book, The Highly Sensitive Child, which is what it says it is, The Highly Sensitive Person Love, and The Highly Sensitive Person Workbook, which the last third of it is about how to set up a pretty much fail-proof group of sensitive people to talk about various issues. It's all outlined and laid out so that it works for people. And the rest of it is about going into personal issues that are related to sensitivity. People like that workbook.
I bet.
So,
well, Elaine, we're getting close to running out of time, so let's have you read just a little bit more from The Highly Sensitive Person.
Okay. Well, maybe I'll read something about the infant body. I liked the image that our sensitive bodies are a little bit like infants, and it's hard for us to pay attention to our sensitive bodies because everybody else around us is not required to pay so much attention, and so we tend to try to ignore it. So I wrote what your sensitive infant body might say to you. So this is a body speaking to you, to a sensitive person. Please don't make me handle more than I can. I am helpless when you do this, and I hurt all over. Please, please protect me. I was born this way, and I can't change. I know you sometimes think something awful must have made me this way, or at least made me worse, but that ought to give you even more sympathy for me, because either way, I can't help it. Either way, don't blame me for how I am. What I am is wonderful. I let you sense and feel so much more deeply. I am really one of the best things about you. Check in on me often and take care of me at night at that moment. Take care of me right at that moment if you possibly can. Then when you can't, I can trust that you are at least trying and I won't have long to wait. If you must make me wait for my rest, please ask me nicely if it's okay. Only more miserable and troublesome if you get angry and try to force me. Well, listen to all the people who say you spoil me. You know me. You decide. Yes, sometimes I might do better left alone to cry myself to sleep. But trust your intuition. Sometimes you know I am too upset to be left alone. I do need a pretty attentive regular routine, but I'm not easily spoiled. When I'm exhausted, I need sleep. Even when I seem totally wide awake, a regular schedule and a calm routine before bed are important to me. Otherwise, I will lie awake in bed all stirred up for hours. I need a lot of time in bed, even if I'm lying awake. I may need it in the middle of the day, too. Please let me have it. How are we doing for time?
We're good.
Yeah, we're fine. A couple more minutes.
Okay. Get to know me better. For example, noisy restaurants seem silly to me. How can anybody eat in them? Not such things. Keep my toys simple and my life uncomplicated. Don't take me to more than one party in a week.
Good advice.
Might get anything in time, but I don't do well with a lot of sudden change. Please plan for that, even if the others with you can take it and you don't want to be a drag. Let me go slow. But I don't want you to coddle me. I especially don't want you to think of me as sick or weak. I'm wonderfully clever and strong in my way. I certainly don't want you hovering over me, worried about me all day, or making a lot of excuses for me. I don't want to be seen as a nuisance to you or to others. Above all, I count on you, the grown-up, to figure out how to do all of this. Please don't ignore me. Love me. And like me as I am.
That is a really good perspective to
it
have.
It is. Very good.
Yeah, that's fascinating.
Especially the last sentence.
As I am.
Yes, as I am. Right.
So, Elaine, you said you're working on something very different now, because you don't necessarily want to be the empress of the highly sensitive person.
Right. I am writing a book called The Undervalued Self, which is based on the idea that all human beings and all animals, I've always liked evolutionary biology, have two things that they do all day. One is to rank themselves, like if you have two animals and you have a bone to give the two dogs, you know, one always knows which one is going to get that bone first. Look at a herd of horses and you go up to the fence with a carrot, there'll be some squabbling. Only one horse is going to have that carrot, and that's the dominant horse. And they know their rank, and usually there's not that much fighting. They know their rank. We humans, we know where we stand in any group. We may be the kind of group in which we don't usually think about it that much, but we love to play sports, and that's all about ranking.
Mm.
There's clear ranks.
Mm-hmm.
So we rank, but also we link. I mean, the most basic things about social animals is that they're social, that they link up, they want to be in groups. The mother and child are the first link, and we love to link, and we're very friendly. So I'm saying that a person who is often plagued by feelings of feeling inferior in their rank, of feeling lower in rank than they really are, so that it's a real problem for them, they miss opportunities, saying that the problem for them is that they're in ranking mode too much. Psychotherapy patients, I've noticed, and lots of other people, even in a situation where love is available, and as much as they want love or friendship, they often interpret the situation in terms of ranking. They think, oh, I'm not good enough, they won't want me. Or, I don't want them, for that matter, that look boring or something like that. Or they'll just think the situation is about ranking. You know, they're kind of comparing clothing or money, how much money that person might have. And, oh, you know, popular because she's got so much money. It doesn't have anything to do with how nice she is. So what we want to do when we're in that ranking mode and feeling bad about ourselves is switch to linking rather than... My problem with the term low self-esteem is it sort of says, oh, try to get yourself higher in that hierarchy. But I think if we simply switch to linking with others, then it tends to go away. The problem of our self-esteem, we just stop thinking about
ourselves.
So
just ignore it.
A lot of people have said that, and I think it's just another way of describing it.
So you ignore the hierarchy.
Hmm?
You just ignore the hierarchy.
Or the hierarchy, yes. Yeah. Like people who, you've seen people say in athletics, you can some people minimize it and are really friendly with each other before and after the competition, and other people are just grim. There's no way of making friends with them. They're just determined.
Yeah.
And it's not just introversion, extroversion, although, you know, there is that factor. Because even, you know, when you have two people alone together, they can link or they can rank, and there's just real differences in how much people do that.
So, Elaine, does this book have a title set?
It is called The Undervalued Self,
okay.
And it has some subtitles that I'm going to have to memorize. But
and when will it be published?
Wreck Your Rank, Link, and Balance. You know, we don't have a publication set yet because this is a nice combination of the two subjects. They gave me deadlines, and I didn't write well under the pressure of the deadline.
Ah.
So at some point, my editor said, we just want a really good book. So.
Ah.
No deadlines. And so the book is actually in her lap, and I'm not giving her any deadlines, but we're...
Well, I'd love to hear more about that, but unfortunately we're out of time now.
Well,
this has been most interesting, most interesting.
Thank you so much for being with us on Writer's Voices, Elaine.
Oh, you're welcome. It was a pleasure.
And we will close Writer's Voices today, as we usually do, with a quote from Mom.
Okay, this is interesting. Kindness can build on itself as well as violence can. So be kind.
So stay tuned now for Planet Earthwild. If you're listening on Friday, if you're listening to our rebroadcast Monday morning, stay tuned for the Cult Show, and we'll see you next week on Writer's Voices. Writer's Voices is hosted, produced, and engineered by Monica Hadley, Caroline Kilborn, and Shemaine Montana. Archives available at KRUUFM.com and WritersVoices.com. Writer's Voices is a production of KRUULP 100.1 FM, broadcasting from the Cultural District in Fairfield, Iowa.